A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's the kind of question that only someone who actually lives here would think to ask. He points out that Jerusalem is famous primarily for its relationship with God, not for industry, not for culture, not for natural beauty, but for what people believe about the divine right here on this particular patch of ground. And yet it's also one of the most physically divided cities in the world. His question is, among the people who actually seek out Jerusalem's holy sites, the devout Christians, Muslims, and Jews who make the pilgrimage, is there a shared religiosity that connects them more deeply than their theological differences divide them? And in a world increasingly hostile to religion, might the faithful have more in common with each other than with their secular neighbors?
It's a question I've thought about a lot, partly because I ended up here almost by accident. I was a Jewish kid from Ireland who never quite fit, and I wanted to be part of building the State of Israel. Jerusalem wasn't the plan, it just happened. And then one day you look around and realize you're living in the only city on earth whose primary export is holiness. That's not a metaphor. The city's economy runs on pilgrimage, religious study, and the sheer gravitational pull of sacred real estate. But the thing that struck me, and I think this is what Daniel's getting at, is the gap between the idea of Jerusalem and the reality of it. The name itself, Yerushalayim, contains the word for peace. And yet the city has been conquered something like 44 times, destroyed twice, besieged 23 times, and was physically split by a wall until 1967.
44 conquests, and they named it City of Peace. That's either the most aspirational branding in human history, or the most ironic.
And that tension is exactly what makes Daniel's question worth digging into. Because if you visit Jerusalem as a pilgrim, let's say you're a devout Catholic from the Philippines, or a Muslim from Indonesia, or a Jew from Brooklyn, you're coming here because this place matters to your relationship with God. That impulse, that pull toward the sacred, is genuinely shared across traditions. The question is whether that shared impulse translates into actual understanding between people, or whether it just puts them in parallel lines at different holy sites.
And Daniel's framing is interesting because he's not asking whether interfaith dialogue happens in some abstract sense. He's asking whether the city itself, its physical reality, its history, its institutions, actually facilitates the kind of encounter that could ripple outward into a more harmonious world, or whether the whole thing is just managed separation dressed up as coexistence.
That's where it gets uncomfortable, because Jerusalem has been doing managed separation for centuries, and it's good at it. The question is whether being good at preventing violence is the same thing as building understanding.
Where do we even start with this? Because there's the ideal. Jerusalem is a light unto the nations, a model of how different faiths can share sacred space. And then there's the actual machinery of how the city handles religious diversity. And those two things are not the same.
They're almost opposites. Let me give you the most vivid example I can think of. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the site where Christians believe Jesus was crucified, buried, and resurrected. It's shared by six denominations: Greek Orthodox, Roman Catholic, Armenian Apostolic, Syriac Orthodox, Ethiopian Orthodox, and Coptic Orthodox. And the way they share it is governed by something called the status quo, a set of arrangements frozen in place by an Ottoman firman in 1852 and later baked into international law through Article 62 of the Treaty of Berlin in 1878.
When you say frozen, you mean frozen. There's a wooden ladder on a ledge above the main entrance that has been sitting in the exact same spot since at least 1728. Nobody moves it because moving it would change the status quo, and changing the status quo could trigger a fistfight between monks, which has actually happened.
In 2008, Greek Orthodox and Armenian priests got into a brawl over a procession route. The ladder is still there. It's become a symbol of the whole system, coexistence through paralysis.
The model for sharing Christianity's holiest site is essentially a legal framework designed to prevent anyone from doing anything. That's not interfaith dialogue. That's a ceasefire with architectural features.
It's not just the Christians. The Temple Mount, or Haram al-Sharif, the most volatile religious site on the planet, operates under a similar logic of separation rather than sharing. After 1967, Israel made the decision to leave the site under the religious administration of the Jordanian Waqf, while Israel maintained security control. Non-Muslims can visit during specific hours but cannot pray. In 2023, a Jewish man was arrested for praying silently, just moving his lips, no sound, and that counted as a violation.
The mechanism for keeping the peace at the most contested piece of ground in the world is, you can look, but you can't participate. That's the arrangement.
And if you go back even further, to the period when the temple actually stood, the arrangement wasn't more inclusive, it was hierarchical. The temple had concentric zones of holiness. The outer court, the court of the Gentiles, was open to non-Jews. But there were signs posted in Greek and Latin warning that any foreigner who entered the inner courts would be responsible for their own death. We've actually found one of those inscriptions. It's in the Istanbul Archaeology Museum now. So even when Jerusalem was at its most unified as a Jewish pilgrimage city, the religious logic was not everyone welcome. It was, you can come this far and no further.
Which means Daniel's question about whether there was interfaith connection in the temple period has a pretty clear answer. There was contact. The court of the Gentiles was a real space where non-Jews could be present, but it was contact within a framework of exclusion. You could observe, you could be proximate, but you couldn't fully participate. That's not dialogue. That's a velvet rope.
Here's the thing that I think is important to sit with. None of this is a bug. The separation, the status quo arrangements, the careful management of who can do what, where, this is how Jerusalem has always worked. The Ottoman millet system, which governed religious communities under the empire for centuries, was built on the principle that each community, Jewish, Greek Orthodox, Armenian, Muslim, would govern its own internal affairs, including personal status law, and contact between communities would be primarily transactional. Trade, services, the practical stuff of daily life, not theological exchange.
The historical pattern is parallel communities, separate legal systems, minimal theological contact, and elaborate rules to prevent conflict over sacred space. That's the Jerusalem model. And it's been remarkably effective at what it's designed to do, which is prevent the city from descending into religious war every generation. But it's not designed to create understanding.
And that's the tension at the heart of Daniel's prompt. He's asking whether Jerusalem can be a place where shared religiosity creates genuine connection. But the city's entire institutional history is oriented toward preventing exactly that, because when people with competing claims to the same sacred ground actually engage with each other's theology, things tend to get worse, not better.
Which brings us to the paradox he's pointing at. In a world where religiosity is declining in the West, where being a person of faith is increasingly countercultural, you might expect the devout to find common cause across traditions. And there's some evidence for that. The 2023 Jerusalem Declaration, signed by Jewish, Christian, and Muslim leaders, explicitly affirmed religious freedom and opposed religious coercion. That's a real thing that happened. But whether that elite-level solidarity translates to the street level is a very different question.
The street level in Jerusalem is one of the most segregated urban environments in the world. East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem, Muslim majority and Jewish majority, have minimal daily contact. The separation barrier, completed in the 2000s, physically divides communities that were already socially divided. You have Christian pilgrims from Korea visiting holy sites in one bubble, Jewish tourists from America in another, Muslim pilgrims from Indonesia in a third. They're all here for the same reason. This city matters to their relationship with God, but they're not talking to each other.
Daniel's observation that religiosity is probably more of a commonality than faith itself is sharp, but it cuts both ways. Shared piety is real. You can see it in the way a pilgrim at the Western Wall and a pilgrim at the Dome of the Rock both approach their sacred space with the same kind of reverence, but that shared piety doesn't automatically translate into shared understanding. Sometimes it intensifies the competition, because both parties believe with equal intensity that this particular piece of ground belongs to their relationship with God.
That's what we want to trace through this episode. The historical mechanisms that have shaped interfaith contact in Jerusalem, the millet system, the status quo, the Temple Mount arrangements, the modern institutional attempts at dialogue, the interfaith councils, the grassroots programs, and whether they actually work. And the bigger question that Daniel is really asking, can a city built on particularist claims, this is our holy place, this is our covenant, this is our tradition, become a model for universal understanding?
Or is managed separation the best we can hope for? And if so, is that enough?
I think to answer that, we have to get clear on what we're actually talking about when we say interfaith understanding. Because there's a difference between shared religiosity, the fact that you and I both believe in God, both structure our lives around worship, both feel drawn to sacred places, and actual interfaith dialogue, where you understand enough about my tradition to see the world through my categories, even if you don't accept them.
Shared religiosity is a feeling. It's the recognition that the person across from you at the holy site is having an experience that's structurally similar to yours. They've traveled a long way. They're standing in front of something they've read about their whole life. They're praying. You recognize the posture, literally and figuratively. But that recognition doesn't require you to know anything about what they actually believe.
And that distinction matters because Daniel's question has two layers. The first is whether that feeling of recognition exists, and I think it clearly does. You see it in the old city every day. The second layer is whether that feeling translates into anything durable. Does it change how communities relate to each other? Does it build the kind of understanding that could ripple outward, as he puts it? And that's a much harder question.
Which is why Jerusalem matters as a case study globally. This isn't just a local curiosity about one city's religious politics. Jerusalem is the most concentrated example on earth of what happens when multiple faith traditions all claim the same ground as irreplaceably sacred. If shared religiosity can't produce genuine understanding here, where the stakes are highest and the density of devotion is off the charts, then it probably can't do it anywhere.
The counterpoint is, if it can work here, in the hardest possible case, then the lessons are exportable to every other religiously divided place on the planet. Northern Nigeria, Myanmar, parts of India. Anywhere sacred space is contested, Jerusalem is the laboratory.
We're going to look at this in three moves. First, the historical mechanisms. How Jerusalem has actually managed religious diversity across centuries, and whether there was ever a golden age of interfaith harmony. Spoiler, there wasn't.
Second, the modern institutional attempts at dialogue. The councils, the grassroots programs, the declarations, and whether they're actually changing anything on the ground.
Third, the harder question Daniel is really driving at. Does the city's religious density create unique opportunities for understanding, or unique obstacles? And if it's the latter, what does that mean for the idea of Jerusalem as a light unto the nations?
Let's start with the history. Because the way Jerusalem managed religious diversity in the past set the template for everything that's happening now. And the template is not what most people assume. Take the Ottoman millet system. Most people have never heard of it, but it's the operating system that ran Jerusalem for about 400 years. Under the Ottomans, each religious community, and they defined community by faith, not ethnicity, was a millet. The Greek Orthodox millet, the Armenian millet, the Jewish millet, and Muslims fell under the general administration of the empire. Each millet had its own courts, its own tax collection, its own internal governance. If you were a Greek Orthodox Jerusalemite and you had a marriage dispute, you didn't go to an Ottoman judge. You went to your bishop.
You had entirely parallel legal worlds operating in the same few square kilometers. Different laws for different people based on which god they prayed to.
And the system was designed to minimize friction by minimizing contact. You didn't need to agree with your neighbor's theology because you never had to submit to your neighbor's religious authority. The millet system created what historians call coexistence without integration. You lived next to each other, you traded in the markets, you probably knew each other's festivals by the sounds and smells, but you didn't worship together, you didn't intermarry, and you certainly didn't sit down to discuss comparative theology.
Which actually sounds remarkably stable. 400 years is a long run for any system of managing diversity.
It was stable. It was also rigid in ways that would feel claustrophobic to a modern person. Your religious identity determined your legal identity. You couldn't opt out. If you converted, you changed millets and your entire legal framework shifted. The system treated religion not as private belief, but as public jurisdiction. And that mindset, that religious communities are fundamentally separate legal entities that happen to share geography is still baked into how Jerusalem operates today.
When we talk about the status quo at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, we're not looking at some quirky anomaly. We're looking at the millet logic applied to a single building.
Applied with a level of granularity that borders on absurd. The 1852 Furman didn't just say the six denominations will share the church. It specified who controls which chapel, which altar, would step on which staircase, at which hour. The cleaning schedule for the windows is regulated. And the ladder, that immovable ladder on the ledge, is the perfect symbol because it's not there for any religious reason. It was probably left by a mason doing repairs sometime before 1728. But because nobody can agree on who has the authority to move it, it stays. For 3 centuries.
3 centuries of ladder-based diplomacy. That's a niche expertise.
The monks who manage these arrangements are probably the world's foremost experts in a field that doesn't have a name. And what they're managing is not dialogue. It's the prevention of conflict through the prevention of change. Every inch of that church is frozen in its 1852 configuration, and any alteration is a potential trigger.
Which makes you wonder what the alternative would even look like. If you unfroze the status quo tomorrow, would the 6 denominations suddenly discover a shared Christian brotherhood and start co-officiating Easter services? Or would the Greek Orthodox and the Catholics immediately start fighting over who gets to control the tomb?
History suggests the latter. In 2008, during the Palm Sunday procession, Greek Orthodox and Armenian priests got into a physical fight over whether an Armenian priest could enter a part of the church the Greeks considered theirs. Israeli police had to break it up. These aren't theological disputes. Nobody was arguing about the nature of the Trinity. They were arguing about territory. Sacred real estate functions like real estate.
The frozen peace is preferable to the thawed alternative. That's a dark thought.
It's the Jerusalem logic. And if you think the Christian arrangement is tense, the Temple Mount makes it look relaxed. The current arrangement dates to June 1967. After Israel captured the Old City, Moshe Dayan made the decision to leave the Islamic Waqf in administrative control of the mount. The Israeli flag was taken down from the Dome of the Rock within hours. Dayan understood something that a lot of people miss. Military victory doesn't translate into religious authority. You can conquer a hilltop, but you can't conquer a belief.
The arrangement that emerged. Israel controls security and access. Jordan's Waqfa controls religious administration, has held for almost 60 years now. That's not nothing.
It's not nothing, but it's also not sharing. Non-Muslims can enter during limited hours through a specific gate. They can walk around. They cannot pray, cannot bring prayer books, cannot move their lips silently, as that case in 2023 demonstrated. A Jewish man was arrested for standing still and mouthing words. That's the actual enforcement mechanism.
From the Waqf's perspective, that enforcement is essential, because any visible Jewish prayer on the mount would be seen as a challenge to the site's Islamic status. So you get this bizarre situation where Israeli police are arresting Jews for praying at Judaism's holiest site in order to prevent riots that would follow if they didn't.
Which is the Jerusalem model in its purest form. The goal is not justice, not dialogue, not mutual understanding. The goal is preventing the thing from exploding. And it works. The mount hasn't become the trigger for a regional war, despite being the most emotionally charged piece of ground on earth. But it works through separation, not through encounter.
If you go back to the temple period that Daniel asked about, you see the same logic operating in a different key. The temple had concentric rings of access, the Holy of Holies. Only the high priest, once a year, on Yom Kippur. The inner courts, only Jews in a state of ritual purity. The court of the Gentiles. Non-Jews could enter, but there was a stone balustrade with inscriptions warning that anyone who crossed further would be killed.
We have one of those inscriptions. It says roughly, "No foreigner may enter within the railing and enclosure around the sanctuary. Whoever is caught will have himself to blame for his ensuing death." Josephus describes it. The temple wasn't a universal house of prayer for all nations. Not in practice. It was a Jewish sanctuary with a designated observation deck for everyone else.
Daniel's question about whether there was interfaith connection in the temple period. The answer is that there was proximity. Non-Jews came to Jerusalem for festivals. They were present in the outer court. They saw the rituals, but they were spectators, not participants. The architecture itself enforced a theology of graduated holiness, where some people were closer to God than others by birth.
That's the thread that runs through all of these cases. The millet system, the status quo, the Temple Mount arrangement, the temple itself. Jerusalem has never had a golden age of interfaith harmony where people of different traditions sat down and learned from each other's theology. What it's had is a series of increasingly elaborate mechanisms for managing the fact that multiple traditions claim the same ground, and those claims are fundamentally incompatible. That historical pattern of managed separation brings us to the present. And the question is, do the modern interfaith institutions actually change any of this, or are they just a nicer-looking version of the same machinery?
Because you've got the Interreligious Coordinating Council in Israel, ICCI, founded in 1991. Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Druze leaders sitting around the same table. The Jerusalem Interfaith Council, established 2012, runs dialogue groups, educational programs.
And I don't want to dismiss what they've accomplished. The ICCI has done important work on religious freedom issues, and the Jerusalem Interfaith Council has created spaces where clergy who would never otherwise meet actually sit in the same room. But here's the uncomfortable question. If you stopped a random person on Jaffa Street and asked them to name one thing the Jerusalem Interfaith Council did last year, what would they say?
They'd say the what?
These organizations operate at the elite level, bishops and rabbis and imams. And elite-level dialogue has value. It can prevent crises, it can create back channels, it can produce statements like the 2023 Jerusalem Declaration. But it doesn't necessarily change the lived reality of the city. The average Jewish resident of West Jerusalem and the average Muslim resident of East Jerusalem don't interact with each other, don't shop in the same places, don't send their kids to the same schools, and don't know anything about each other's religious lives except what they see on the news.
The physical city reinforces that. The separation barrier didn't invent the division between East and West Jerusalem. It just made it concrete. Before the barrier, the division was social and psychological. Now it's a wall.
Even where there isn't a wall, there's a kind of invisible architecture of separation. The pilgrimage bubbles Daniel mentioned. They're real. A Christian tour group from Korea visits the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the Garden Tomb, maybe the Mount of Olives. A Jewish group from New York visits the Western Wall, the City of David. A Muslim group from Indonesia visits the Dome of the Rock and Al-Aqsa. They're all in the same square kilometer of the old city. They're never in the same room.
They're parallel processing holiness. Same input. Sacred Jerusalem. Entirely separate outputs.
That's the paradox of Daniel's shared religiosity thesis. He's right that the posture of devotion looks similar across traditions. You can watch a Jewish man davening at the Kotel and a Muslim man prostrating at Al-Aqsa and recognize the same human impulse. But recognizing it from the outside is not the same as the two of them recognizing it in each other. The pilgrim in her bubble sees other pilgrims as background scenery, not as fellow travelers.
Which gets to the darker implication. Shared intensity of belief doesn't necessarily create solidarity. It can intensify the competition. If I believe, with every fiber of my being, that this ground is holy because of what my tradition says happened here, and you believe, with equal intensity, that it's holy because of what your tradition says happened here, we're not allies in piety. We're rivals in a zero-sum game over the same sacred real estate.
That's where the common enemy idea gets complicated. Daniel suggests that in a world increasingly hostile to religion, the devout might find common cause across traditions, and there is some evidence for that. The 2023 Jerusalem Declaration, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim leaders explicitly affirming religious freedom and opposing coercion. That's a real document with real signatories.
It's fragile, and it's elite-driven. At the street level, I'm not sure the average religious Jerusalemite feels more solidarity with someone of a different faith than with a secular neighbor who shares their language, their nationality, their daily concerns.
A secular Israeli and a religious Israeli might disagree profoundly about the role of religion in public life, but they both send their kids to the army. They both speak Hebrew. They both worry about the same traffic on Route 1. A religious Jew in Jerusalem and a religious Muslim in Jakarta share a belief in God, but they don't share a country, a language, or a set of daily practical concerns. Shared religiosity is real, but it's thin compared to the thickness of shared national life.
The hierarchy of commonality, in practice, seems to be shared citizenship first, shared religiosity a distant second.
Which brings us to the role of the city itself. Because Jerusalem's physical fabric, the narrow streets of the old city, the markets in the Muslim quarter, the light rail that runs from Pisgat Zeev in the north all the way to Mount Herzl in the west, these create unavoidable proximity. Jews and Arabs ride the same train cars every single day. They stand next to each other, holding the same handrails.
I've ridden that light rail plenty of times. It's a space of encounter in the most minimal sense. People are physically present to each other. But they're not talking. They're looking at their phones, or staring out the window, or managing their children. Proximity is not dialogue.
That's the question that the urbanists and the peace builders keep coming back to. Does contact, just being in the same place, actually change anything? The evidence from the social science is mixed. Contact under the right conditions, equal status, common goals, institutional support, can reduce prejudice. Contact under the wrong conditions, unequal, involuntary, superficial, can actually reinforce it.
The light rail is contact under the wrong conditions. Nobody's equal on the light rail. Everyone knows who lives where, who's getting off at which stop. The stations announce themselves in Hebrew, Arabic, and English, and that trilingualism is the most interaction most passengers will have with the other community that day.
Which is why the interfaith programs that actually seem to work don't start with theology. They start with shared practical problems. The Jerusalem Peacemakers Group brings together Jewish and Muslim religious leaders, but they don't sit around discussing interpretations of scripture. They work on community safety. They run youth programs. They address the things that actually make people's lives harder or easier, regardless of what they believe about God.
Kids for Peace is the same model. Jewish, Christian, and Muslim kids in the same summer camp. They're not doing comparative religion seminars. They're playing soccer, they're eating together, they're doing the stuff that kids do. The encounter happens through action, and the understanding, if it comes, comes afterward.
Dialogue follows action, not the other way around. And that's the important insight, because a lot of well-meaning interfaith work gets this exactly backwards. It starts with, let's understand each other's theology, and hopes that understanding will lead to cooperation. But in a place like Jerusalem, where theologies are fundamentally competing, starting with theology just surfaces the incompatibilities faster.
The programs that work are the ones that bypass the theological layer entirely and build relationships around something else. Shared space, shared problems, shared activities. The theology is still there in the background. Nobody's pretending it's not. But it's not the starting point.
Which brings us to what someone listening to this episode can actually take away. Because Daniel's question isn't just philosophical, it has practical implications for anyone who cares about interfaith work, or who visits Jerusalem, or who's trying to understand religious polarization anywhere in the world.
The first takeaway is uncomfortable. The Jerusalem model for interfaith relations is not dialogue. It's managed coexistence through separation and status quo. That's what the millet system did. That's what the status quo at the Holy Sepulchre does. That's what the Temple Mount arrangement does. It has kept the city relatively peaceful for decades, in some cases centuries, but it has not created understanding. And if you're expecting Jerusalem to be a model of interfaith harmony, you're going to be disappointed. That's not what the city is designed to do.
Here's the flip side. Managed coexistence is not nothing. The fact that the Church of the Holy Sepulchre has not become a battleground, despite six denominations sharing it under rules that everyone finds frustrating, is a genuine achievement. The latter is still there, and that's better than the alternative. Sometimes the goal is not understanding. Sometimes the goal is functional, nonviolent coexistence. And Jerusalem shows that it's possible to achieve that without anyone agreeing on theology, or even on who rightfully owns which staircase.
That's a lesson that travels. Northern Nigeria, parts of India, Myanmar, anywhere sacred space is contested, and the stakes feel existential. The Jerusalem example says you don't need to resolve the theological dispute to prevent the violence. You need mechanisms. Frozen arrangements that everyone hates equally, but accepts because the alternative is worse.
Second takeaway. And this is for anyone who actually does interfaith work or supports it. The programs that work are not the ones that start with theology. They start with shared practical problems. The Jerusalem Peacemakers Group and Kids for Peace both operate on this principle. Build relationships through action and let understanding follow if it follows. Starting with, let's understand each other's beliefs. In a place where those beliefs are fundamentally competing, just surfaces the incompatibilities faster.
That's counterintuitive for a lot of well-meaning interfaith initiatives. The instinct is to bring people together and say, tell us about your faith. But in Jerusalem, that conversation doesn't lead to harmony. It leads to everyone realizing that their claims on the same piece of ground are mutually exclusive. The programs that bypass the theological layer entirely and build relationships around soccer, or summer camp, or cleaning up a neighborhood, those are the ones that actually change how people see each other.
Third takeaway, and this is for visitors, Jerusalem offers a unique opportunity to observe religious diversity in its most concentrated form anywhere on earth. But genuine encounter requires stepping outside the pilgrimage bubble. If you come here and only visit holy sites with your group, you'll see other pilgrims as background scenery. Go to Mahani Yehuda Market on a Friday afternoon. Ride the light rail. Sit in a cafe on Emek Rephaim and watch the city go by. The shared spaces, the markets, the public transit, the parks, those are where you actually see how people of different traditions navigate proximity.
What you'll see is not harmony. You'll see something more interesting. You'll see people who have developed elaborate, mostly unspoken rules for sharing space without sharing belief. The light rail is not a site of interfaith dialogue, but it's a site of interfaith functioning. And in a world of increasing religious polarization, that's worth paying attention to.
Which is the broader lesson. Jerusalem shows that coexistence is possible without consensus. The status quo system is not ideal. It's rigid, it's absurd in places, and it does nothing to create mutual understanding. But it has prevented the Church of the Holy Sepulchre from becoming a war zone for over a century and a half. In a world where we're constantly told that deep religious differences must lead to conflict, Jerusalem is evidence that they don't have to. Not because people learn to understand each other, but because they learn to build structures that contain the disagreement.
That might be the most honest thing Jerusalem has to teach. Not that we'll all come to see each other's truth, but that we can figure out how to share a city and a world without that happening.
That leaves us with the question Daniel's really asking, even if he didn't phrase it this way. Is managed separation enough, or does Jerusalem's role as a light unto the nations demand something more?
The phrase light unto the nations comes from Isaiah. It's a Jewish idea, but it's been borrowed and reinterpreted by other traditions too. The city is supposed to model something, a way of living with God that the rest of the world can look at and learn from. If what we're modeling is frozen conflict in parallel lives, that's not exactly inspiring.
Maybe that's more honest than the alternative. The world is not short on inspiring rhetoric about interfaith harmony. It's short on examples of deeply divided religious communities managing to share space without killing each other. Jerusalem has done that, imperfectly, for a long time. That might not be the light anyone wanted, but it's a light.
The future makes this more urgent, not less. The religious map of the world is shifting in ways that make Jerusalem's experience suddenly relevant to places that never had to think about this before. Christianity is growing fast in the global south, Nigeria, Brazil, the Philippines. Islam is growing in Europe. Meanwhile, secularism keeps rising in the United States and parts of Western Europe. You're getting more religious diversity in places that used to be religiously homogeneous, and more religious intensity in places that used to be secular.
Which means the Jerusalem playbook. How do you manage sacred space when multiple traditions claim it? When the claims are incompatible, and when everyone is operating at high intensity. That playbook suddenly matters in cities that never thought they'd need it. London, Paris, Berlin. These places are going to have to figure out what Jerusalem has been figuring out for centuries.
The uncomfortable answer Jerusalem offers is, you don't resolve it, you contain it. You build the rules, you freeze the arrangements. You accept that the ladder stays where it is because moving it costs more than leaving it. That's not a satisfying answer for people who want transformation, but it might be the only honest one.
Which brings me back to Daniel's personal journey, and I think this is where the question lands for him. He grew up as a Jew in Ireland feeling out of place, and he dedicated himself to building the state of Israel. Jerusalem was an accident. and now he lives in a city defined by its relationship with God, asking whether that city can turn particularist claims into universal understanding.
It's the same question at the personal and the civic scale. Can you be deeply rooted in one tradition, one people, one covenant, one story about what happened on this hill, and still be a bridge to people whose traditions make competing claims about the same ground? Daniel's life is an experiment in that question, and so is Jerusalem.
I don't think we get a clean answer. The city has not figured out how to be a bridge. It's figured out how to be a container. That's less than the prophets promised, but more than most places manage. And maybe that's the honest starting point for anyone who cares about this. Not how do we create harmony, but how do we build structures that hold the disagreement without letting it burn everything down?
The harmony, if it ever comes, will be built on top of those structures, not instead of them.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The largest ant colony ever recorded was discovered in the 1930s on the Chatham Islands, where a single supercolony of Argentine ants spanned over 6,000 kilometers of interconnected nests linked by pheromone trails. Meaning, an ant from one end could theoretically recognize an ant from the other as family.
6,000 kilometers of ant bureaucracy. Somewhere there's a ladder they can't agree on either.
The one thing Jerusalem and an ant supercolony have in common, everything runs on rules nobody voted for.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping the whole thing from descending into chaos. Managed separation works in podcasting too, apparently.
If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps more than you'd think. Find us at myweirdprompts.com.
I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry.
See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.